From WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining us. Later on today's show, my colleague Rachel Keith joins me to talk about public education funding, starting with this week's announcement from the endowment, which is proposing a $116 million grant to help support projects identified in the upcoming school bond, but only if that bond passes. Plus, we'll take a broader look at the current funding struggles and some potential issues on the horizon. But first, my colleague Aliyah McConnell has a portrait of the family of Edilberto Espinoza Sierra, the 21-year-old who was killed in a downtown Wilmington parking deck by law enforcement in March. In this first part of a series looking at the issue, we look at who Edilberto was and what his life was like before his death.
It's been over a month since the family of Edilberto Espinoza Sierra learned about his death, which has left them with many questions. I'm Aliyah McConnell, and in part one of this series where I break down the details of this case, I sat down with the family to learn who Edilberto was and how the family is working through their loss. This year, Easter Sunday weighed heavily on the Espinoza Sierra family. On this day commemorating the resurrection of Christ for many, the Espinoza Sierra family says they dream that one day their beloved son, brother, and friend, Edilberto, will live again. Here's Elizabeth Sierra Navarro, the mother of the deceased 21-year-old, recalling a dream her youngest daughter had of Edilberto after their family got news that on March 8th, he was shot and killed inside of a parking garage downtown by officers of the Wilmington Police Department and deputies of the New Hanover County Sheriff's Office.
She dreamed of him. She saw herself gazing at him, just staring and staring. She spoke to him and she embraced him, telling him that it was all a lie, meaning that he was actually alive. Then she woke up and she saw that it wasn't true.
As I've said, it's been over a month, and the family was left to contend with their loss and dozens of unanswered questions. And even though they'll never be able to see, hug, or talk to Edilberto again, they've vowed to keep his memory alive somehow. Just so all of our listeners are up to date with what happened on the night of March 8th, let me go over a few key details. WPD officers, along with deputies from the New Hanover County Sheriff's Office, were responding to a shooting that took place at the 2nd Street parking deck downtown, which resulted from two fights that broke out moments before. According to a WPD news release, when officers arrived, they found a man suffering from a gunshot wound. Officers spoke to witnesses as the gunshot victim, who was later identified as 26-year-old David Corpus, was transported to the hospital. Meanwhile, they detained several suspects in the process. Edilberto, who had apparently been badly injured in the fight that occurred earlier, was behind the wheel of his blue Dodge Charger, trying to exit the garage when officers attempted to flag him as a potential suspect. In the video, it appears that officers are calling out to him to stop the car. However, he continues to speed off. As the car whipped around the corner, officers discharged their weapons. According to WPD, they deployed their weapons after the vehicle accelerated, striking another vehicle and narrowly missing several officers. They believe the driver, Edilberto, to be an imminent threat. Video footage from bystanders of the fight and of the officer-involved shooting have circulated online, but it only paints part of the picture. Now, his family is on a mission to fully understand why this incident happened the way it did. And we'll have a part two of this story to discuss more of the nitty-gritty details of the fallout from the incident that led to Edilberto's death and how his family's been handling it. But for the purpose of this episode, Let's remember Adalberto, who his friends and family lovingly refer to as Beto, for who he was. I spoke with Espinosa Sierra's family on Easter morning. I was joined by his sister, Genesis Espinosa Sierra, his father, Adalberto Espinosa Maldonado, and his mother, Elizabeth, who you heard from earlier. Now, here she is again.
He was an affectionate son and hardworking and a very respectful worker. He never disrespected anyone, always speaking to people with respect and good manners. At work, they miss him and loved him so much because he was just hardworking, polite, respectful young man, and he was the same way with me.
And this is his sister, Genesis, who shared some fond memories of him as well.
On my part, I would definitely say that, yeah, even though me and my brother were not very close, I knew my brother. And my brother, he was very, 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 very funny. Whenever you would see him, he would just have a smile on his face. And you would be like, why are you so happy, you know? He was like, I don't know. It's like he never had a lot of money, but he was always very, very happy. And I was like, that's very admirable because not a lot of people can be content with their lives.
His sister, Genesis, who is 19 years old, says even though she and her brother weren't that close, the love he had for his family was always felt. And she was no exception. And according to his family, Adalberto had a lot of love to share with everyone, almost too much.
I won't lie, my brother was handsome, you know, he had a couple girlfriends, you know, for his age, you know. Actually, that same night that the event had occurred, he had gone up to his car because he was about to go, after the first initial conflict, he went up to his car because he was going to go see a girl. And he had even called her before the other fight broke out.
She says three of his girlfriends came to pay their respects at his funeral, describing them as crying and comforting each other.
They still came because, you know, they knew deep down he didn't deserve that. He didn't. And he was still such a loving guy, a little too loving, but yeah. One of them spoke and talked about how she has a baby, and he would change that baby's diaper, even though that wasn't his kid. And he would stay with the baby and sleep with the baby in his room.
Genesis says that just goes to show the kind of character Adalberto had. He cherished family and even aspired to start one of his own one day.
He wanted a baby and he wanted to have that responsibility and to take care of that kid and, you know, to have that to push him forward more because he already did so much for his family. And, you know, it's just so sad to think that he's, you know, that got taken away from him. In the words of my own mom, you know, the police murdered him. They took all these opportunities away from him.
The family's frustration over this situation is understandable. But we want to note that the accusation of murder is a strong one. But the actual process of bringing charges against any law enforcement officer is a long one. In this case, starting with an SBI review of the shooting, which is still underway. Still, their mother shared the same sentiment.
He had so many aspirations. He had even gone back to school and was working. My son said, I want to have my own business. Yes, he really wanted to own a business one day. He dreamed of so many things, having a family, having children. But instead, they killed him. The police killed him. I still don't understand why they killed him.
I met up with the family at their home in rural Wallace. By following a road contoured by farmland so vast it would take hours to trek, until a humble one-story home emerged from a lush green vale. Stepping out of the car, I was greeted by a flock of chickens and a newborn kitten being groomed by its mother, and then a perky chihuahua gleefully leapt out of the front door along with its human, who I recognized as Genesis Espinosa Sierra. Together, they ushered me inside the home. Once inside, I caught up with Genesis and her family as they prepared for a cookout.
We all originate, well, except for obviously the younger ones.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Us.
Yeah.
We all originate from Honduras.
Yeah.
Like, at least 20 plus years.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. All Duplin County babies. Yeah, we all kind of grew up together, me and my cousins.
Here's Eldeberto's uncle, Selvin Espinosa, speaking proudly of his nephew for being the only one out of his siblings and cousins to go back to Honduras and experience the banana plantation that he and his brother, Eldeberto Sr., grew up on.
My son went to Honduras, but never went to the banana plantation.
Mm-hmm.
But Betito is the only one so far that went to the banana plantation. Wow. And walked where we used to walk as a young age. So he was the only one. Oh. Yeah, he said he liked it. He liked it. I mean, the way life is over there, but he loves, you know, Dublin County. I mean,
as part of my visit, I toured Eldeberto's room while one of his aunts refreshed the vermilion paint on his walls. It was modest in size and sort of utilitarian in a way. Aside from a few mementos, there was a bed, nightstands on either side of it, and a dresser. All the basic bedroom needs. No more, no less. As his family has said, he really didn't need much to be happy. Here's Genesis, guiding me through some of his keepsakes.
He used to play soccer. These are all his soccer tournament,
trophies.
His trophies, yeah. Let me see. Oh, this is another soccer trophy. Yeah, he was really, he may have been chunky, but he was athletic. Surprisingly very athletic young man.
And sitting near his bed, I noticed a small teddy bear.
It was a Build-A-Bear, and my mom had left it a message in there for him. And it's just also because, like, I mean, he was still a kid. I'm sorry, but if you're living with your parents, you're still a kid. Like, you're still very much, like, I'm not saying he wasn't a grown man paying taxes and, like, obviously, like, working and stuff. But, I mean, you're still with your parents. You haven't even had a child yet. You haven't even lived. Like, you know what I'm trying to say? So it was just kind of to show that kind of, like, kid aspect of him. And then this is just, like, I like my little sister made this one. It said Forever 21, but it kind of, like, the letters ripped off a little bit. But, you know, because he is forever 21 now. Oh, they have, this is one of the verses that we're actually burying him with. Basically, it's, in God only, my soul is quiet, and from him comes my salvation. So that's like, that might not be the right translation. I just translated it from the Spanish one, so I might be a little bit wrong. But that's the one we're burying him with, and we have his obituary here.
That verse Genesis is reciting is Psalms 62:1, and it says, "For God alone my soul waits in silence. From him comes my salvation." She says her brother wasn't overtly religious, but he kept reminders of his faith, like crosses and Florida water, which is a type of citrus-scented cologne used for religious or spiritual practices in the Caribbean and Americas. And he even had an offering table dedicated to family members who've crossed over. Now, his room is kept up in the same vein as what looks to be his ofrenda, which is a different type of altar for people who have passed on. Or think of it as a time capsule of his life that keeps the memory of him alive.
Yeah, you know, and I feel like it does help us in a sense, though, because, like I said, we didn't get to have those last moments. I feel like there is an aspect to be missed, of course, but I feel like a lot of times in Hispanic cultures, death is very celebrated. And not in the sense of like, oh, we're happy, like, but in the sense that you want to celebrate the life they had, not the death that they had. You know what I mean? Because Betito, for a 21-year-old, lived a very, very, very joyful life. Like, he was just always smiling and giggling and laughing. And, you know, he tried to live his life to the fullest.
As anyone can imagine, the grieving process has been a lot for the family, especially after losing someone so suddenly and in such a violent way. Members of the family say it's an especially heavy burden for Edilberto's mother to bear. Here's Edilberto's aunt, Marlene Gonzalez, speaking on the impact Beto's death has had on his mother.
So, you know, my sister-in-law, she go to the cemetery every single day. Yeah, in the morning, in the afternoon. She cried a lot. She stayed there, asking her son, come alive, come alive. You know, it's very painful, yeah.
And here's his mother, Elizabeth Sierra Navarro, once again, putting those emotions in her own words.
Emotionally, I feel like I'm just living dead. I feel like I'm just walking. He was very close to his little sister. She dreamed of him. She saw herself gazing at him, just staring and staring. She spoke to him, and she embraced him, telling him that it was all a lie, meaning that he was actually alive. Then she woke up, and, well, she saw that it wasn't true.
And my mom finds herself asking the same questions. How do you tell somebody who's already gone from this world, from this planet, from this, you know, life to come back? She visits his grave every day and asks him that and asks why. I feel like this will always stay with us.
The family has started an online petition addressed to all Wilmington City Council members, requesting the release of the names of the 7 officers responsible for shooting Edilberto and release of the body cam footage, as well as charges brought against the officers involved in the shooting. But just a note here, because of state law, releasing law enforcement video can be a difficult process, requiring a judge's order. While City Council can't unilaterally release the body cam footage, even from city police officers, they could support requests for it to be made public. Likewise, the decision to charge officers is out of the city's hands. It would begin with an ongoing SBI investigation and then fall on the district attorney's office. But in the petition, it states, quote, supporting this petition means placing public pressure on the agencies and organizations that are either complicit in Edilberto's murder or have the power to facilitate justice. It means allowing the family to grieve without the distraction of confusion and outrage. It means upholding the memory of Edilberto, who was known to everyone as a kind, beautiful soul and will be dearly missed. Genesis actively canvasses for signatures, finding public spaces to share Edilberto's story face-to-face with the people of this community. And so far, out of a goal of 800 signatures, the petition has 612.
A lot of people can, even just hearing from the story or seeing it on the news, agree. And I'm very glad to, because obviously there's always that doubt that one has to how the media will perceive things. And it's been a great support what people have done for us, because it shows that this city wants a change. So they want these 3 demands to be met just as much as we do. And I'm grateful to anybody who has signed this and has even just reached out and given us these videos, because without this community and without these people who are so willing to help us, we would not have half the information we have right now. And if anybody has any more videos, please send them to us.
The family says, like the officers involved, they want those involved in the altercations to be brought to justice as well. However, they did not disclose exactly to what extent or if they'd be seeking legal action. Stay tuned for part 2 of this story, where we'll dive deeper into the incident itself, and we'll also hear from Edilberto Espinoza Maldonado, Beto's father, to discuss what information could be gleaned from the vehicle. There will also be photos and more information about this story available at whqr.org. I'm Aaliyah McConnell. Thank you to the Espinoza Sierra family for sharing their story with us. And thanks to our voiceover actress for helping with the translations in this episode. and thank you for listening to WHQR.
All right, well, we need to take a quick break, but we'll be back in a moment with my colleague Rachel Keith as we talk about education funding, starting with this week's announcement from the endowment. I'm Ben Schachman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for staying with us. Up now, a look at public education funding. As you probably know, it's a complex issue for North Carolina school districts, which have to juggle, and sometimes it seems beg for, funding from the federal, state, and local government level. As local and state governments both look to tighten their budgets, public schools can get stranded. And that's been the situation here in New Hanover County, with one major difference: the $1.7 billion endowment, which has grown out of the sale of New Hanover Regional Medical Center to Novant over 5 years ago. It's a lot, but for parents, students, teachers, and the community as a whole, it's also important. So, with me here to unpack all of this is my colleague, Rachel Keith. Rachel, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So, we are recording this on Thursday, and our scheduled sort of agenda of things we wanted to discuss got disrupted a little bit by a last-minute announcement from the New Hanover Community Endowment.
Yes, and you went to that press conference, which was Thursday morning. And what did you learn, Ben Schachman?
So the big announcement, which they got right into, is a $116 million grant from the endowment to New Hanover County that is designed to support the $320 million school bond that's going to be on the ballot in November. So I know we are throwing some big numbers at you. So here's how this breaks down. This doesn't change the existing plans for the school bond. That $320.5 million bond will still be on the ballot in November. The public will still have to vote for it and approve it. If and only if that bond passes, then the endowment has agreed to give $116 million in 10 annual payments, so $11.6 million every year for a decade, to the county. And that would start in 2028. That's the same year that construction would probably start on some of those school bond projects. The endowment gave the county pretty free range to use this however they want within the world of those school bond projects. So they could take that first $11.6 million check and just pay for concrete and steel. Or they could use it to pay down the debt that they're taking on that year. The bottom line for taxpayers is pretty much going to be the same no matter how the county does that. And this was the big headline for some fiscal conservatives, is that we had been expecting a 1.75-cent tax increase to go along with this bond. So, for example, if you have a $500,000 house, that would have been somewhere around $87.50 a year in extra taxes. This will reduce that down to a half penny, which is about $25. So that was the big takeaway from Thursday morning's meeting. There's lots of other details, but that was the headline news.
And the projects on the bond, this announcement does not disrupt what's going to be funded by this school bond that the county and the school board have decided upon.
Exactly, yeah. It is not quite a blank check, but it doesn't come with any strings in terms of the endowment saying, well, we really want to see you do this project or that project. And we did have some questions because we kind of knew this was coming, at least by last weekend, we were pretty sure this was coming. So some of the questions were, you know, would there be strings attached? There are some conditions in this grant. There's some collaborative projects that the MOU between the endowment and the county suggests that they should do. A lot of that has to do with looking at enrollment, which schools are over-enrolled, which schools are under-enrolled. There's also an actual requirement, so this has to be done. And this is a parent guardian survey about where kids are getting childcare from before they come to kindergarten, and that could inform future endowment grants. Could, not necessarily, but could. And the rest of the collaboration kind of has to do with encouraging the district to pitch grants for technology improvement and some other things that the endowment could consider in the future. But in terms of the endowment stepping in saying, you have to spend this money on this stuff, no. Another question we had was, couldn't the endowment have been involved earlier? So one of the issues we've heard, for example, is that you know, the bond committee, which you covered pretty closely. I mean, they had some intense negotiations about what the most important projects are, because this $320 million doesn't cover all their needs.
That's right. And we know that only phase one of New Hanover High School is covered in this bond, this November bond. But that leaves $170 million left unfunded for phases two through four. However, if the county does decide to pay down some of this debt, that could mean potentially, if they decided that they could take on more debt and potentially do capital projects on their own, maybe another phase of New Hanover, because this lift allows them more flexibility to fund more projects in the future.
That's exactly right. And I spoke to some of the county commissioners who kind of agreed with that assessment. I know there are folks who wished that committee that had school board members and county commissioners on it had kind of known there might have been this extra wiggle room financially. But the point is, now going forward, they will still have more financial flexibility than they otherwise would have. Because we had been hearing that without the endowment stepping in, this might be the last school bond for a decade, maybe longer. So the last question we had was about previous discussions we have heard with the endowment when it came to funding for schools, specifically this school bond. And some folks may remember in December, the endowment held one of its two public meetings, and an audience member actually asked some of the endowment leadership, hey, why don't you guys just pick up the whole tab for the schools? So I put that question to Shannon Winslow, who's the chair of the endowment board, on Thursday.
So last December, during the endowment's public meeting, an audience member asked the endowment if the endowment could pick up the tab for the school bond, and they were told that was prohibited by founding documents. What changed?
I'll take that. Thank you, Ben. I answered that question, and I do recall that was the first question out at the listening session. My interpretation of that question was that the audience member and citizen was asking about the endowment taking down the $320 million, the full amount. And as I indicated, our governing documents and bylaws state that we cannot do that in its entirety, and because that would be supplanting, which would violate our APA. So nothing has changed. What we are doing is we are supplementing what the county is doing, and we are coming alongside them. So to answer your question in summary again, nothing has changed. It's the semantics of the question and how I answered it, which was factual.
So you can hear audience members chuckling a little bit there at the end. Winslow is correct. Factually, she's correct. Semantically, she's correct. I will note that during the December meeting, that kind of nuanced answer wasn't offered. It was just, no, we can't do that because our founding documents don't allow it. At the time, Winslow didn't say, but we would consider funding, say, $160 million of it. So I think the public was left with the idea that the school bond was not something the endowment could have any part in. That may not have been accurate, but I think that's what the public felt. I will note that the MOU between the endowment and the county repeatedly hammers this point that this endowment grant cannot be a replacement for pre-planned or existing county funding for the schools, and it can't be the reason that funding diminishes in the future. So to Winslow's point, paying for the whole thing is out of the question, and it can't be the kind of thing where they step in and are just replacing funding that the county would otherwise be providing.
And you talked to the CEO of the endowment, and she told you, well, you asked why now? The details of the bond have been hashed out. So why now come up with this funding when maybe this could have been secured earlier on?
So yeah, I got a chance to talk to the endowment's CEO, Sophie Desjardins. Her response was, it's not a simple answer. She said, we got involved when we were needed. It did take a lot of people kind of by surprise that they just stepped in and announced this. I think even school board officials only really found out about this 2 days before the announcement was made publicly. And some were thrilled and some were a little skeptical because this did seem to come out of nowhere. It seems like conversations with the county have been going on a little bit longer. Ultimately, the decisions about timing, about when to announce, when to step in, that's up to the endowment, and those conversations, as we've said many times before, happen in private meetings, and so we kind of have to read the tea leaves when we can, but otherwise, we get surprised like everyone else. So that's what's going on with the endowment. Again, exciting for many people. A few people still have some additional questions about how this will play out. But it's worth noting this is just one piece of a much larger puzzle. So I want to pull the camera back, as you told me, way back,
yeah,
to look at, you know, where the money is coming from for public education here.
Yes, that's right. So big picture lens, we have the overall budget is $333 million for New Hanover County Schools. And 61% from last year came from the state, 34% came from the county, and then 6% came from the federal government. So you have all these different government entities supporting the school system. And so they have to cobble together all those funds to operate New Hanover County Schools.
And part of this conversation that I feel like we have every year is that the state, I think it is fair to say, has not lived up to its bargain. The state is supposed to pay for operations. The county is supposed to pay for facilities like new schools and maintenance and stuff like that. But the county has stepped in year after year, more and more every year, to provide that operational support when the state has fallen short. And this is something that has been a matter of bipartisan frustration at the county. And we know the state is making some moves to try and address that, and we'll get to that. But it has kind of colored the conversation a little bit where, especially for like the superintendent and the school board, they kind of feel like they're asking for scraps because the counties are already doing more than they have to by law.
Yes, and Superintendent Dr. Christopher Barnes has said subsistence level over and over again. And we know that the fiscal cliff happened for the school district a couple years ago, and they're in much better shape right now. But it was interesting to watch the budget negotiations this year. So Dr. Barnes had anywhere from $500,000 to $2 million in additional funding that he needed from the county. And he had all these different scenarios. Well, if I ask for $2 million, then I'm going to cut this. But if I ask for $500,000, I have to cut all of these things. But the county ended up giving $3.3 million in additional funding. He's always said, Dr. Barnes, I need way more than that. Last year, he said they compensated for a $6 million loss. So he is used to trying to come up with creative solutions for diminishing funds. But they did get more than they were asking for. Of course, he could have asked for more, but he was trying to be, quote, he says, a good steward of public money when it is crunched.
Yeah, and like I said, it can be kind of a delicate negotiation. It's also worth talking about, you know, the way that the county sees this is that they see their funding not just for capital, but for what they're filling in for the state, because the state has just fallen so short year after year. But also things like pre-K and nurses and mental health experts who work in the schools. So they, depending on how you slice it, I mean, the county has been occasionally a little salty, basically, that they feel like they don't get credit for everything they do. And there are a lot of different ways that they step in and support the schools. I think it's one of the interesting things is the way they do that is based on enrollment rate. So it's like a how much money per student they're providing, which is, you know, just one way of doing the accounting, sure, but it also means when we see decreasing enrollment, we can run into some funding issues.
Yes, and this has been a fight over the last couple years. Okay, if they have less students, why are we giving them more money? It doesn't make sense. But over the past decade, only 13% of school districts have across the state, and there's 115, have seen an increase in student populations. And New Hanover County Schools has seen about a 10% decline in student enrollment. That is mainly, that came out this year, that it's more so about falling birth rates. It's also about families moving to surrounding counties because of high costs living in New Hanover County. And yes, the state, we have talked about this, has monetized the private school voucher program for all income levels. And so we're not seeing a big flight, but it is a factor in this discussion. But I will note, Pender and Brunswick counties are in that cohort of increasing student population over 10 years. And Brunswick County is at the top of that list for student enrollment growth across the state.
Yeah, and we've seen from, you know, other analyses that the out-migration to Brunswick and Pender from New Hanover has been notable. Even though our population is growing, you can see how financially, especially, you know, working families would be seeking out the, relatively speaking, lower costs of housing and maybe dealing with a commute that's a little bit longer. But that's, it is a complicated factor, but those numbers are going down for New Hanover County, which means that impacts the conversation about how much money they're going to get specifically from the county.
And going back to the big endowment grant, they are asking the school district, and the school district is already doing that. They're looking at either a consolidation plan or a sustainability plan, because like you said, some schools are over-enrolled, some are under. And Dr. Barnes said, if this trend continues, that means they are going to have another 1,000 less kids, students, in the next 5 years than they have now. So they do have to do some planning, some shuffling potentially in the future to account for this loss.
Yeah, one other thing I wanted to note coming down to this per student issue is that the state does this too, where it's looking at enrollment, but it's not necessarily the same dollar amount for every student. And this is something that Superintendent Dr. Chris Barnes told you about.
This is where it gets a little dicey, right? Like, so the state says we give an average of 11,000, 12,000, whatever dollars per pupil, but that doesn't come out in the equal amounts. We get about $7,000 per student because they have things like small county money, disadvantaged student funding, things that prop up other districts. And this is where when people jump on our county commissioners, they're not just investing in the school system, they're also compensating for other districts who don't have county commissioners who can't support them.
So what he's saying is that New Hanover County, we all know, are one of the wealthier counties in the state. So we don't qualify for these additional funds per student. So that's what he's saying. But then the state is just taking the average per pupil number and saying this is what the average is. And he's saying that New Hanover County Schools is way below that state average for spending per student.
Right. And, you know, speaking of that state funding, there's been a lot of conversation over the last, you know, 5 or 6 years about where exactly North Carolina is in the rankings, because there are different ways to look at it to give some credence to what Republicans, who have been in charge of the state budget for years now, have said. And you can measure it in terms of effort, which is like, you know, how much revenue does the state have and how much of that goes towards schools. Or you can look at it in terms of absolute dollars. One of the complaints in the past has been that, let's take $7,000 per student as a hypothetical. $7,000 doesn't go as far in, say, New York State as it does in, say, North Carolina. There are regional differences.
And that's not accounting for local and federal funds.
Exactly. Yeah. So it is very complicated, and there are some difficulties in just trying to do an apples-to-apples comparison between, say, like, oh, look, Washington, D.C. is giving this much per pupil, and we're not. But all of that said, I think we have reached sort of an inflection point where, even with all of those caveats stacked on top of each other, it still looks really bad. North Carolina's rankings are really low. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's fair. And the Education Law Center, so North Carolina, it gives it an F, 50 out of 51. That would include the District of Columbia. F for funding effort. That would be the percent of GDP that we spend on education. However, the state has been doing a little better, a C in funding distribution. So that would mean giving more to high poverty districts. There's a positive point there, but teacher pay, it's ranked towards the end. And people like House Speaker Destin Hall, who is a Republican, is seeing now, and he's been saying this to our colleagues at WUNC in the NC newsroom, that they are understanding that teachers are going to places like South Carolina or Virginia to get that higher wage, and that the state legislature has to do something. They are doing something now, which we will talk about. And they have, or he has said that he will continue to bump that up in the future, is what he has said.
All right. Well, we need to take one more quick break, but we'll be back in just a moment with more with my colleague Rachel Keith as we continue tackling the complex issue of public education funding. I'm Ben Schachman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for staying with us. We return now to my conversation with my colleague Rachel Keith about public education funding. Yeah, so two things I want to take here. One is that for almost a year, North Carolina has been without a budget.
The last in the country.
The last in the country to do so. We're actually almost into a new budget cycle where we just miss one. And what that means is that when a state like North Carolina doesn't pass a budget, it just reverts to last year's budget as a blueprint. But that means cost of living raises, which are really the only weapon against inflation, don't get implemented. And so that's been very frustrating for folks. We do see some movement now between the House of Representatives and the Senate in North Carolina. We're cautiously optimistic that we will see a new budget. One thing that's been frustrating, I think, for school districts, and you got into this with Dr. Barnes, is that there's some deferred maintenance on salaries here. So the state's going to implement a larger than average increase as an acknowledgement that it has been over a year since they should have had the last one. But that means that local districts kind of have to respond financially, but they've already been doing their budget, and they, at a certain point, couldn't really wait for the state anymore. So what does this do to, like, our local budget?
Yeah, and it's yet to be determined because technically the legislature has released a new pay schedule, but it's not set in stone yet. The budget has not officially passed. But we're looking at, again, it is similar to the past salary schedules in which the higher bumps go to beginning teachers 1 through 6. So that those percentage increases are 10% and above. But when you start to look at 15 years and above, except for year 24, they're at 5%. And what Dr. Barnes has budgeted for salary increases is 3%. But now we know that the average is 8%. So the wrench here is that the commission funds 666 positions, and the state, for context, funds 2,253. Total employees is 3,300 about. Some of those are federal funds, but you can see that a huge chunk, you know, the county commission funds. And guess what? When the state passes a raise, it's only for those state workers. That's who they're accounting for. They're not accounting for those raises for the local positions. So I'm saying to him, what are you going to do?
Right, because you could have a situation where, you know, you have two teachers with an equal amount of experience teaching equivalent classrooms, but one's set up to get an 8% raise and one's set up to get a 3% raise. So that's a problem. So here's what Barnes told you.
First, I would be cautious for any educator to walk out and say, I've got an 8% raise coming or I've got a 3% raise coming without a bill in my hand, because I don't want anyone to get caught surprised either. And that 8% average does not mean 8% for everyone. It's going to take some time for us to make sure that we have it done correctly. And for us, I'm not going to worry until I see a bill that gets signed. And I can do all the back of the envelope math that I want, but I will tell you that I am not going to be okay with losing student-facing positions for anybody.
He is saying, which he has done in budgets past, that no teacher is going to lose their job because of a raise for another teacher. He said, quote, it's just not going to happen. So what he would do is probably funnel people around to different schools, change positions, close vacancies. What he has said is that there will be a job for you. It might not be the job that you have currently. And again, we don't have a bill in hand, so he knows it's coming, but he said that he's been cutting at pretty much every single year, so he's used to this predicament. He said that him and Ashley Sutton, his chief financial officer, will be able to handle it, is what he's saying.
Yeah, and again, you can understand the frustration of teachers who hear, maybe on the news, a teacher's getting an average 8% raise. That doesn't mean that they're getting that, both because that's an average, and also because, as Barnes points out, until the budget is signed and approved, you know, you just don't know for sure.
And WUNC did an article this week talking to veteran teachers. They constantly say that they are not included in the larger percent increases. And so they are saying, the voices were, what is the state doing to keep me around, to stay in the system? Because we hear from research that veteran teachers, experienced teachers are really important in the school system. So they are saying, you know, what are you doing to value me and my profession? And right now we're seeing that master's pay, that's not been added. And they have national boards is another way to get a pay raise. But the state's not going to do a back pay just because they've missed all those percent increases. There are some bonuses, 1,000 or 500, depending on how many years you've served as well. So it's a complicated picture, but the state is doing something. In years past, they have not.
Right. And so those are the two big frustrations with the state. One is the delayed budget means, you know, no annual cost of living increase. And then the situation that it sets up for the district, which then has to figure out how to fund those locally funded teachers to keep them at the same level of the state. Otherwise, it's going to feel unfair. It's terrible for morale.
And New Hanover County is not alone. He says every county in the state, the local government does support the operating costs through staff salaries. So everybody, he is saying, will be facing this predicament.
So there's two more things I want to touch on before I let you go. One is we saw a lot this year. We've seen it in past years, but it was pretty high profile this year. And that was protests from what is essentially the teachers' union in North Carolina. Now, not everyone knows this, but we've talked about this a lot in the newsroom. Collective bargaining is illegal under a state law for government employees. So some people get confused. We get emails about this, about, hey, I heard Starbucks is unionizing, or, you know, this other group is unionizing. The staff of WHQR is unionized. So why can't the teachers unionize in the way that they do in states like New Jersey, where they can collectively, make their demands and negotiate directly with the state?
Yeah, it is law that the state bars collective bargaining with them. You can join a union. You can pay dues. The state, since we're right to work, you do not have to pay those dues. Even if you join a union, you're not barred from, but the state, the legislature, they will not negotiate salaries or any other type of working conditions with anybody from that union. And on the table right now is a constitutional amendment to potentially put that in the state constitution, even though it's law, but put it in there as well that this is a right to work state.
Yeah. There's also some tension here. You will often see conservative lawmakers and conservative news outlets refer to, the protests or the marches in Raleigh by the Association of Educators as a strike. And they use that language. And the teachers union avoids that word for a very specific reason, is that striking is specifically outlawed for government employees in state law. I think it's interesting. There have been a lot of incidents of saber rattling, you might say, but there's never been a successful attempt to push through legislation that would give the state law more teeth. And here's what I'm talking about. For example, if thousands of teachers all decide on the same day they're going to use their personal leave, and they go through all the appropriate procedures, they give the district enough notice, they make sure there's a substitute, the district approves it.
5 days, yeah. Notice.
Mm-hmm. They've jumped through all the hoops. That is their personal time, and it is theirs to do whatever they choose to do with it. And what they all choose to do with it is go to Raleigh to protest. In some ways, that has some of the characteristics of a strike, in that it does put districts in a situation where they have to change what they would normally do. It has an impact. Right? And that's what a strike is supposed to do. On the other hand, it does not completely cripple the local schools, because those districts can say no to personal leave if there just aren't enough substitutes to go around. So it's like a quasi-strike. It's not all the way of a strike. It does get the media attention. It gets the school district's attention. And so it's in this gray area. And obviously, the state legislator has not had the political will to say, let's go hardcore, and start jailing teachers for breaking the law. But they do like to frame it as in a way that makes it these teachers are causing harm to the public.
Yeah, that they're doing something illegal. And, the local chapter said they explicitly told people not to take sick leave because that would be falsifying information. They had to either take that personal leave or they had to take leave without pay. So they went those routes. So it is their time, and we do have those on that other side that said, it doesn't matter. This is what it is.
Yeah. So that's why you've heard some of those things in that debate. And the last thing I want to touch on here is some issues on the horizon. There's a few things here. One is we've already talked about, the county, and they are right to say this, goes above and beyond what the law requires them to do in terms of operational funding, which is supposed to come from the state. Now, there's people who like them to do more. And that includes our state senator, Republican Michael Lee. And we've heard other folks in the General Assembly say they'd like to see counties do even more to support the schools. But that can be tough for a number of reasons that we've been talking about in the newsroom.
Yes. Senator Michael Lee has said in the past that he'd like for school funding it to be 45% coming from the state and 45% coming from the local county commission. So how would the local commission come up with those additional funds? It's likely that they would have to raise property taxes. If they're not going to raise property taxes, then what is it, sales tax? Is it everybody looking to the endowment for those additional funds? And if they're not going to raise those taxes or get those additional revenue streams, what are you going to have to scale back? So that's the conversation that this community needs to have about where the money is coming from.
And of course, the endowment can only spend money in one of 100 North Carolina counties. It's not spending money in Brunswick or Pender County or Duplin or anywhere else. So there's lots of other counties that are facing this potential funding crisis without an endowment to help them out. Complicating this, there are now a number of constitutional amendments, state constitutional amendments, that we may see on the ballot in November that would do two things. One would be to limit, permanently put a cap on income tax, although state Republicans are already planning to take it below that. The idea here is that if Democrats were able to take control of the General Assembly, they wouldn't be able to then raise it. Another one would, in ways that aren't quite hammered out yet, limit increases in property tax, where counties get the majority of their funding. They get the lion's share of their funding from property tax. The next largest is sales tax. And so, again, looking at our budget, there are not a lot of places left to cut. And I think a lot of counties have done this. The economic situation has been difficult over the last years. You can make a good case for austerity. But without the tools of property tax, it's going to be difficult. And if that's happening at the same time as the state is asking counties to step up even more to fund education, you can see this kind of coming to a head at some point.
Yes, and that state income tax would be capped at 3.5%, which you said could be tapered down. We know that the corporate income tax rate is in the process of being phased out entirely. So yeah, where is this funding come from? This local property tax, it sounds like for now on the ballot in November, it will say, do you want to limit this? And that they would decide at a later time what that limit would be.
So we'll have to put a pin in that and keep an eye on it. But just know that funding schools and negotiating between state and federal and local funding and getting that all to work is difficult enough, and there are some things on the horizon that could make it more difficult.
And last couple notes, the school board just listened to a presentation by a contractor who did a master study of all of the facilities in New Hanover County Schools, and they have $2.5 billion in needs currently. Of course, they're not going to do all of those, but there are a lot of things to work on in the district. And people say again and again, what about the North Carolina lottery money? I believe that the district only gets a couple million for capital improvements from that fund. This is not a windfall to the district.
Yeah, we do know after our conversation with State Auditor Dave Bullock that he's doing a performance audit of the education lottery because revenue has been significantly up, but the funding stream to the schools has not borne that out. I think it's important work. I'm glad he's doing it. It is not enough to fix the bigger education funding problems that we're talking about. So when people bring up the education lottery, I'm like, yes, it could help, but it will not fix it.
Right.
All right. Well, that's all for now. Rachel Keith, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for today's episode. Thanks to Aaliyah McConnell for their reporting, Rachel Keith for joining me here in the studio, and as always, WHQR Program Director Ken Campbell for technical support. Music for today's show was provided by If These Trees Could Talk and Blue Dot Sessions. If you have questions, comments, concerns, or an idea for a future show, you can email us at newsroom@whqr.org. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.